But I'd like to call the meeting to order and like to go ahead and recess the supplemental meeting and move straight into a moment of silence. As we do that, I want to make special note of one of our active members that passed away this month, Marcus Evans. He means a lot to the department. He's mentored a lot of young firefighters along the way. I believe he had 36 years of service, and he died unexpectedly last month. It's tragic and it's shocking to our department. So just asking for a couple of extra little prayers as we go along. But with that, I ask for a moment of silence. All right. Thank y'all. The consent agenda. Spoke with Kelly. There's nothing unusual in this month's consent agenda, unless there's something that changed in the last little while. Would you like to expound on that?
There's nothing unusual. We do have the annual earnings test. Those aren't unusual. They're just only typically on one or two meeting agendas a year, but nothing unusual. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. And then we have last month's minutes of the meeting. Assuming that everybody's had a chance to review those, can I get a motion to approve the minutes?
Mrs. Ken, so moved.
Steve Ido, second.
Steve with a second. Any discussion? Any opposed? Motion passes. Thank you. Next agenda item we have is a detailed consent agenda. Can I get a motion to approve the consent agenda, please?
Tina, motion.
Thank you, Tina. Can I get a second?
Michael, second.
Michael with a second. Thank you. Any discussion? Anyone opposed? All right, motion passes. Thank you. We'll go on to item D1, public comment. And if there's anybody from the public that would like to speak, I believe it's 5-star. Is that correct, John?
It's star 5.
Oh, no, I'm sorry, star 5.
No, you're right. It's 5-star.
Oh, 5-star. Okay, 5-star. Do we have anyone, John?
I do not see a hand raised.
Okay. Well, let's go ahead and move on to item C1, the portfolio update by Ryan.
Thanks, Armando.
So before Ryan starts, oh, I'm sorry, Ryan. I know I told you I wasn't going to do this, but I changed my mind. So I'll let Ryan start, but you'll see the order of the agenda is different because we don't have any closed session items for this month's investment portfolio, which is pretty unusual. So that's why we did the investment items first. But one of the things I wanted to point out, since neither Bill or Nick are here, and some of the most important decisions that the board will make are the asset allocation and the assumed rate of return, items related to that, we're going to have conversations about them. It's good to talk about those items a few times before you actually make a decision anyway. So we're going to have the conversations, but we're not seeking a motion on the asset allocation or the assumed rate of return at this meeting. So sorry, Brian. I know I told you I don't let you do that.
It's a perfect intro. So we're actually going to go back to 17, John, and do the portfolio update first before we get into allocation. So in the portfolio update, actually 18, John. Give me a chance to get there. I'll start with the slide 18, not 28. So I'll just talk about that asset allocation, well, he's getting there, looks pretty similar to last month. We saw the big overweight to real estate with 15% there versus the target of 5. Underweight to EM equity and global equity, up to 37.5% in global, so getting close to that 40% target. And then we'll talk more about the EM equity allocation, where we want that to end up a little bit later on today. On slide 19, this is the asset allocation detail, and always with this chart, I'm going to start at the bottom of the page. So if you can see that adjusted NAV at the end of May was $1.992 billion. That's up about $20 million from last month. The adjusted the adjustment we're taking is down slightly. It was 9% adjustment. Last month, we're down to 7.1%. 100% of that adjustment's in the private equity portfolio. We received final Q4 2020 statements from RED, so we adjusted those NAVs and removed the adjustment from real estate. So 100% of the adjustment is within the private equity portfolio right now. And then towards the top of the page in the middle, we provide detail on where we sit with the global equity managers, and you can see Boston Partners and Manulife have a little bit more money than the two growth managers, Invesco and Walter Scott, based on the value cycling back into favor. Next time we do a rebalancing, we might look at trying to get those back closer to equal weight, but we've been happy to let them run a little bit this year. On slide 20, just quick recap of investment activity. We received $52 million in distributions year to date. We actually received another $5 million last week from the Clarion portfolio, so it's up to $57 million. We have another $25 million expected by mid-July, coming mainly from the real estate portfolio. As you guys know, we're always continue the valuation and engagement on the tail end private equity funds. And then on the small cap RFP search, we provided some memos to you guys for review on where we're at in that process and who we've been talking to. We had 4 interviews with firms this week. We expect to bring finalists into the IAC on June 24th for interviews and review, and then hopefully make a recommendation for approval at the board meeting in July. On 21, we're just looking at the quarterly investment initiatives going forward. I've covered a few of them based on kind of pushing asset allocation out a month. Expect to come back in July for approval, and then maybe into August for updates to the IPS to reflect the updated asset allocation. Once we finish up the U.S. small cap search, the next two things would be launching the international small cap search, and then a review of global equity portfolio structure based on the expected increase in asset allocation there. That's all I have on the portfolio update. Any questions before we move into the asset allocation materials? Okay. 23, John. Actually, sorry, 25. So we got some good feedback from the board last month on the asset allocation discussion with a few follow-up items that we're going to talk about today, mainly on EM equity education and some new possible mixes to look at. Everyone last month was generally okay with the proposed reduction in the safety reserve from 15 down to 9%. And as Kelly mentioned, we'll review some educational materials today, look at a few new mixes, and hold off on decisions until next month. Moving ahead to the EM piece, which Makita's going to handle, but I wanted to make a few comments. Before we get into it, like I said, we get some really good feedback in May, and whether we end up with an overweight to EM, a market weight, or even an underweight, if we're going to have EM equity in the portfolio, I think it's critical for us to educate you guys and justify the allocation to EM. I was comfortable recommending the overweight last month because I like EM equity in terms of the diversification benefit, current valuation levels, growth prospects, and possibility of mean reversion. based on the underperformance as of late. Aaron and Leo are going to go more into those factors and also discuss some of the risk involved in investing in EM equity, but I'll turn it over to those guys now and let them take it over.
Thank you, Ryan, and good morning, everybody. This is Leo. I will lead this section on emerging markets. So we can move on one more page. Here we go. Thanks. So if we take a step back, and what is emerging markets equity? It's simply owning stocks from companies that trade in countries that are denominated to be emerging markets. Now, that composition is dynamic, and it changes with time. Countries are promoted to emerging markets from frontier and demoted from developed markets to emerging. The turnover of these index is higher. It's about 3 to 4 times higher than that for, you know, the U.S. Or developed market indices, highlighting the dynamic aspect that I just alluded to. If you were to look across a pool of investment consultants as well as other outfits that provide projections of returns into the future, almost always emerging markets has higher expected returns, at least over the past decade or two at a minimum, tied together with somewhat greater level of risk or volatility. I'll say that view remains constant, even though, you know, some of the rationale for this case can change. So what we did today is we put together a presentation looking at, you know, pros and cons, or what really promotes these additional excess return from investing in emerging market, and what are also some of the considerations that must be thought of when one invests in this area of the market. So this slide provides a good summary. So I will spend some time here and then pause for questions, and if needed, we can go to specific pages. But the primary case for owning stocks in emerging markets has to deal with growth. These economies start from a lower base, whether you look at the economy or the average household or the average individual. And so in investments, it's all about the rate of change, right? It's about, you know, if it is 5%, if you start from a lower base, essentially it's a little bit easier. And if you add on top of that, over the last few decades, the ability of these countries to essentially adopt technology that has been developed elsewhere, imagine how easy it is today to grab a phone and have access to mobile banking. Well, many of these economies did not develop those technologies, but it's quite easy to import those technologies, and then it aids tremendously in the growth of the economy. If you look at growth prospects, you'll see that they come down a bit, but they're still materially ahead of developed market economies, and the same happens with productivity. So when you put those things together, you would think that it would lead to higher growth in the economy, and then you would think that, and there is research that supports this, that the rate of return on companies and ultimately on the stocks of those companies is related to that growth, and there is data that supports that. Lastly is demographics. I think this is no surprise and nothing that will be new to you, but these economies have much greater percentage of their population driven by younger people and a smaller group of people that are dependent on those that are working, calling the dependency ratio. That is, those that are under 15 that typically wouldn't be working, and those over 64, you know, essentially think of those as the retirees. And so if you have a lot of people that are not working and a few that are working, then that is a heavy burden, and it tends to lead to lower growth rates. And that's what you see in countries like Japan, primarily, but also other economies. What is a little, I'm not saying it's unusual, but it's a little different, is you would think that these would command a premium to valuation, but in reality, valuations have been lower. One can elaborate as to what could be driving that. But in reality, stocks in the U.S. have run strong for now quite a bit of time. There's been a lot of support that maybe some of these economies in emerging markets might not have been able to put. The reality today is equity valuations for emerging markets are much more favorable than those, for example, here in the U.S. So the first, you know, five bullets, I think I would say those are consistent through time, and I would expect those to be tomorrow. The last one, the equity valuation, that could change. If for some reason emerging markets go and run quickly and U.S. stocks were to decline, then that point for the long-term case for emerging markets, you know, might go away or be diminished somewhat. Moving on to the risk and considerations, very important to know is that the emerging markets, if you were to look at the index today, is very different than it was 10 or 20 years ago. And the most critical difference is the role of China. It's grown in prevalence tremendously. If you go back 20 years, it comprised only 1 or 2% of the benchmark. Today, it's in the high 30s, pushing into 40%. So the concentration has changed a lot. And, you know, there's always debate about how transparent and how reliable the information may be coming out of China. So from that perspective, you know, it's a valid concern to point that out. And, you know, to some degree, one can think about thinking of China on one end, then emerging markets like China on a different level. There's also concentration within sectors. So it used to be mostly commodity and materials-led economies, and it's moving more into consumption. And so you'll see sectors within the emerging market index and the holdings of actual managers to have changed, going away from energy and materials to mostly consumer technology and still some financials. Volatility has been higher. So when we look at rate of returns, we'll look at also volatility, and there's no one can deny that. So if there's been more volatility in the returns, and I think why we can tie that with cyclicality. So during good times, money flows into emerging markets economies, but when the sentiment changes and we go into a risk-off environment, money comes out very fast and indiscriminately, no matter if the underlying recipient, be it a company or an economy, has good prospects. But if there is fear in the market, the capital gets pulled pretty quickly, and you can think of a bottleneck leading to massive forced selling and ultimately declining prices that tend to be more severe than those in the U.S. So that tends to amplify the normal performance cycle within emerging markets. Fourth, if you look at the currency effect, it's been negative. The dollar has been pretty strong over the past 25 years. And so what it means for a U.S.-based investor is that you had a headwind, about 2%, from currencies. We can look into more detail into that, but, you know, if there is some mean reversion and we would expect that with currencies, then that could be a headwind. But again, yeah, it's very difficult to call that, and you know, we wouldn't be making an investment based upon just that. But know that when you invest overseas, how currencies turn out can be a bit of a headwind or a tailwind. And in the past, when you look at performance, it's been a headwind. I will wrap up this before opening up for questions and going into specific pages following up those questions on event and political risk. Those are, yeah, it shouldn't be a surprise that some of these economies can be more susceptible to changes, you know, whether it's one transition from one elect government to the other, or maybe there's not and there's some continuity. But regardless, that creates, again, uncertainty, and uncertainty tends to be penalized in the markets. The last two are more newer. So the impact from COVID-19 seems to be felt today much more strongly on emerging market economies. I would think that perhaps these economies may have less resources, fewer resources to fight it, fewer resources to buy vaccines or to make sure the population receives it. So from that perspective, how that will turn out It's still a bit of an unknown. I mean, if we were just comparing the Americas, the U.S. versus what's happening down south in Latin America, it's very different at this point in time. And finally, climate change, you know, much more of a long-term play, but regardless, the same thesis could apply there, right? You can think of countries like the U.S. or the Netherlands with much greater resources that they can be deployed to try to minimize or manage any impact. And you can think some of countries in Southeast Asia, think of Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, and others, that maybe they would be much more challenged. And so that could create issues. So again, that may show in performance. So long story short, as all things in investment, there is no certainty. There is pros and cons. There is some benefit in terms of diversification. Emerging markets don't move necessarily equally with stocks from other developed economies. And so from that perspective, even if they may be more volatile, it may be a case that they still add value. That was the theory is behind. And performance has been cyclical. The 2000s was a key period when stocks in the U.S. and other developed economies lagged, didn't do very well in the decade of 2000. But emerging market stocks had a fantastic decade there. So we don't know what the next decade is going to bring, but owning some exposure is reasonable, and we can debate what is that right amount when we move on to the next section. The slides on this presentation are pretty easy to read. So we can address any questions you might have, but I would also make sure you read some of the slides in the appendix, which have some good historical performance and data on, and compared performance of U.S. equities to developed market equities to emerging market equities. And you can see the clear trend as to how over the past several years, even when you look at 20-year rolling periods, you see a clear trend towards diminishing returns or lower returns now versus 20, 30, 40 years ago. With that, I'll pause, and I'm happy to take any questions and go into more detail into any one of these sections that may be more relevant. I know that with the comments earlier on, I don't want to speak too long, as I know there's other topics that have to come at 9:45.
Yeah. Hey, Leo, this is Ken. I just got a question on China. I'm coming back from our Texas conference, and there was a class on emerging markets there, and they kind of reiterated the same thing, that China is the emerging market of Asia, not Japan, not South Korea, but China. And the reasons it's pushing that is it's a there's a middle class that's emerging from China. China's allowing a third child to be born now to families. And by the prediction is by 2028, China's economy will overtake ours as far as consumer product buying. Is that kind of what Makita's thoughts are on all this?
Yeah, so I was not a techpert, so I'm not sure exactly what transpired and what the key messages were, but my comment on China was precisely that. It's grown tremendously, and I think in the private markets, China is viewed as a separate and distinct opportunity, where China-only private investments in a fund, like private equity investments, take place and many funds come out. And if you're thinking about emerging markets, it tends to be something else. Within public markets, I think the issue has become what to do about China. Most managers may be somewhat uncomfortable owning half of their fund in China-only stocks. And I think whether you own more or less than China has been a primary driver about whether you outperform or underperform. So from that perspective, at some point in time, if this continues to happen and the projections continue to be that China will grow and therefore the share will increase, well, maybe it might make sense to determine and you treat China on its own, and you may or may not want to have some exposure there. And then you have like emerging markets ex-China. It is a possibility. It may come down the line. We'll see what managers end up coming up with. But it has become a very large portion of the global economy. It is the one piece that continues to grow the most, and so we do expect it to continue to be more relevant. So it's political as well, because it's not truly a free market economy, just the imposition of how many kids you can have will tell you that. So from that perspective, some investors have some other
considerations in terms of morality or sustainability may want to shy away or invest in very specific pockets. So from that perspective, it remains a very relevant topic, and I would agree with your summary observation.
Good. Thank you.
There is a chart also in the appendix that looks at the projections for MUS consultants, and again, it documents why investors tend to own some of the emerging markets despite its volatility. In the case of DPFP, the issue has been one of some reluctancy to invest in private markets, and so in a declining rate environment, if we're looking for an area to try to juice up the return somewhat, that has been maybe the premise. Well, maybe if you put some additional monies into emerging markets, we can improve our odds of making our return assumption without locking up our capital. And so the rest of today's discussion goes into that, looking at different mixes beyond the one discussed at the last meeting to look at the trade-off, right? If we reduce from that 10% emerging market to something else, whether it's 7 or 5 or 8, am I giving up a lot of return or not, and am I benefiting in terms of risk reduction? So I think the short story there is, yeah, it's a reasonable trade-off. You know, if you reduce your return, you also reduce your risk. So what is the overall risk return posture that you want to have?
Hey, Leo, it's Ryan. Can you show that periodic table chart on 56 quickly and just talk about how we should think about that chart in terms of asset allocation,
sure,
and the cyclicality we've seen in
EM? Yeah, so I'll wait for John to pull up that slide. You got to scroll down.
56, John.
I'm sorry, I didn't get the page number.
56.
Towards the end of this section. There.
Right there.
Thanks. So this is simply a table that seeks to provide a very easy visual graphic that performance is all over the map, and what works today may or may not necessarily work tomorrow. And so if you look at blue, you'll see 2019-2020, U.S. equity performed the best. But if you were to go back to the 2000s, you'll see a lot of red. So 2004, 5, 7, and 9, emerging market equity perform at the best. So we don't know what's going to happen in 2021, 22, 23, et cetera. So this tells you, yes, these things don't move alike, and sometimes you see U.S. equity at the top and emerging markets at the bottom, and sometimes vice versa. So in other words, they don't move necessarily in sync, and so from that perspective, it makes sense to own some emerging markets exposure. The same can be said of many of the other asset classes, even commodities, which for much of the last decade, they rank at the bottom, when in the 2000s, they were much closer to the top. On the right, you have two columns. One is a trailing 20-year, and so you'll see what different categories perform, and you'll see private equity was at the top with emerging market equity following very close behind. So I think a lot of people may not realize that emerging markets still have outperformed U.S. equities across most time periods, even when during the last decade, U.S. equity performed much more strongly than emerging markets equity. The main thing was in the 2000s, EM equity performed really, really strongly. You can look at some of those numbers compounding at 78% in 2009 and very healthy gains around 30% for many years, 04, 05, or 06, 07. The last column on the right is the projections from the Mikita annual capital market expectations that we put out. And no surprises, private equity tends to be at the top, and then, you know, follows by emerging market equity. Tends to be about a point difference between emerging markets and developed market economies. So, Ryan, feel free to chime in on this page, but I think this one is an easy visual representation about the benefits of diversification and the unknown as to what the future will bring, which is don't know what's going to work out best next year.
Great, thanks. Yeah, if there are no other questions on EM equity, I think we should move into the asset allocation piece.
That sounds good, Ryan. This is Aaron. I'm going to lead this one. Can you guys hear me well?
I got you.
Great. If you guys could go to the next page, please, the one with the table. So no need to repeat Ryan's intro comments, but, you know, a lot of work's been done previously, the last few meetings on asset allocation. When we left the May meeting, the idea was let's look at a few more mixes with a lower weight to EM equity. So here we're showing five different asset mixes. The first column, the one that says adjusted NAV, that's your starting point. That's where your exposure is today. Then we've got your existing target. Then we have the mix B from May, so no different than what was shown last time. And then we've introduced two new mixes, mix C and mix D. And, you know, the focus here is really on that green box, the breakdown between global equity and EM equity. So all the other lines below it are basically the same for mix B, C, and D. But you can see with mix C, instead of a 50-10, we end up with 53-7, and mix D, 55 to global equity and 5 to EM equity. Go to the next page, please. So here we add in what the projections are from a return and risk perspective. And, you know, the takeaway is if you're looking at the first gray row that says 20-year expected return, that the return projections differences between B, C, and D, I would argue, are not materially different. So as you go from B to C to D, you do decrease a bit in your expected return. And that's because, you know, as we just talked about, the EM equity forecast is slightly rosier than the global equity, according to our models. But, you know, the difference between mix B and mix D is basically 10 basis points over 20 years. On the 10-year, similar difference, and you can see just by and large, the 10-year forecasts are less rosy than the 20, kind of covered that last time. But from a kind of risk-adjusted basis, you know, the Sharpe ratio, which evaluates both return and expected standard deviation, B, C, and D all have the same Sharpe ratio, so theoretically the same risk-adjusted forecast. And all three have the same safety reserve size, 9%. Any questions so far? Go to the next page, please. So we sought to, the goal of this exercise was to produce a mix that has, you know, quote unquote, a market weight to EM equity. So this is, we're calling it the look through to see what is the market weight. So the column that says MSCI ACWI IMI, that is the fund's public equity benchmark. So that is what we're seeking to outperform when you pull together all of your equity managers. That index is also the broadest representation of equity markets. And the breakdown is 12% is emerging market equities, and then the rest, 88%, is U.S. and Europe, Japan, you know, other developed markets. So you can see the length of the bullets here, but there is some assumptions we must make to kind of look through at what your predicted weights will be, you know, if you get to your full allocation, because we're looking at your manager holdings and they do change. We're making predictions on how much you'll have within each manager, how much you have in the index. But with some simplified assumptions, you can see mix B would have about 19% exposure to EM, which is, you know, 7 percentage point overweight to the index. Mix C gets you down to 15 versus 12, and then mix D is basically your market weight. So you'd have, you know, roughly the exact same exposure regionally as the index. All right, any questions? Go to the next page, please. So here we're now bringing the conversation up to kind of what we'll be talking about next with the actuaries, but these are probabilities of achieving different actuarial targets. So the first cluster is probability of achieving or exceeding 6.5, and then you got 6.75, and then you have 7. And when I look at these charts, well, you know, the two takeaways I see is in all cases, the proposed mixes, B, C, and D, have a higher probability than your current target, the blue one. And if you just look left to right, you can tell that naturally you have a higher probability of beating the lower hurdles. So you can, if you just look at that 50 percentage line, you can see where your colored bars are in relation to that at the 6.5, at the 6.75, and then at the 7. Okay, so I'm going to do two more slides that are, I think, interesting concepts as we frame the next conversation with Siegel. So this is the classic normal distribution bell curve. So I remember these from school, where they kind of predict the distribution of where grades will fall. But this is run for mixed D. And so the very point of the curve is the expected return. So that's basically saying that's where, that's the 50-50 point. So half the time, you know, assuming returns are normally distributed, which we kind of know in finance is not necessarily the case, but it's still a good framework where a lot of this work is based off of. But if you make that assumption, half the time returns will be above that 6.89 and half the times it'll be below. And one standard deviation is that gray zone with the two blue bars bordering it. So what that means is two-thirds of the time in any given year, your return should be between minus 7 and 21%. And that basically takes your return, expected return of, if you round up to 7, and then you have your volatility of 14. So to the positive side, you're adding 7 and 14, and to the negative side, you're subtracting 14 from 7. So, you know, important concept that we always talk about on the prior page, how these like very exact numbers, but this is more reflective of what happens in the real world where you have this range of outcomes. So visually look at the orange line, and now let's go to the next page. So the orange line is the same here. It's just the scale of the chart has changed. And what happens is that orange line is kind of your results in any given single year. The blue line is over a 10-year period, and the gray line is over a 20-year period. And basically, what happens is it's saying that over these longer periods, there are, I guess, the impact of those rogue years, those really good years or really bad years, are minimized, and the majority of the time you end up in that tighter band around that 7. So these are just important concepts to keep in mind as we move into the return target conversation. And these are all run off of mix D. Get it off of mix C or B, they're basically going to look the same. So we'll just close. Yep.
Aaron, can you show the next slide, too, on the 10-year return expectations? And given what we talked about last time with the path of returns matter, given our cash outflow situation, I tend to put more weight into these probabilities, given the next 10 years is going to matter more than the following 10. So just talk to this one a little bit, if you don't mind.
Yeah, so we showed you earlier that 10-year forecasts are lower than 20-year forecasts. And we believe this is consistent with what other consultants and large banks and asset managers are predicting. And a lot of that is because of the 10-year period is more influenced by kind of the starting point of where we are and the impact of kind of a reversion to the mean, where 20-year periods are more impacted on kind of historical norms of market dynamics. So on the 10-year period, a lot of these numbers appear lower because you're coming from a starting point with really low bond yields and expensive equities. But if you remember, I framed this page previously looking at that 50% line, and you can see here none of them are near the 50% line. But bringing this back to the EM conversation, you can see the B, C, and D are all pretty tight with each other and all kind of in excess of the blue, which is your current target. And that's because, you know, the B, C, and D all take on a good chunk more equity exposure than your current target. Any other thoughts you want to add?
Aaron, this is Michael Brown. The question on the Sharpe ratio and if the risk profile is not any different by the Sharpe ratio, can you go back to that and why wouldn't you then use that as the indicator for, you know, if the allocation would kind of drive it that way? I don't know if that makes sense in the question, but.
Yeah, it's a useful data point. It's not the only data point, but all else equal, yeah, you would not take an inferior portfolio that has worse risk return kind of ratio if you could get perceived, you know, the same or better return for less risk. But, you know, I'd caution that there, you know, it's only one data point, and to get the highest Sharpe ratio, you could do a very conservative portfolio that is only going to get you 3 or 4%, but you'd have a great Sharpe ratio. So the problem is in the public pension world, you're seeking to earn 6.5, 6.75, 7. You have to go out on this risk spectrum where you are going into assets like equities that, you know, you have to accept a lot more risk for each unit term. Is that helpful perspective?
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, I would just add, I think it's helpful in comparing like mixed B, C, and D that are pretty close in allocation and pretty close in long-term return expectations as far as the risk-return trade-off. But as Aaron said, you know, there could be a mix with a high Sharpe ratio that wouldn't get us anywhere near what we need to get.
Yeah, exactly. There's different ways of measuring risk. So the risk for you guys is not necessarily only volatility, but the real risk is not earning enough money to pay your benefits. So if we take this back to the conversation we had in May, you know, I think the analysis shows that if you want to reduce your EM exposure, and this is if you kind of just fast forward to the summary slide 67, you know, if you want to reduce your EM equity target exposure, it does bring down your forecasted return, but not materially so, because you're just trading one type of public equity for another. So all mixes B, C, and D are going to get you what we believe closer to your current return assumption of 7. But picking between B, C, and D are very minor differences. And it'll ultimately come down to a kind of a comfort zone of the trustees in terms of how much of that EM opportunity and potential risk you're willing to accept.
Okay. Any questions here? And if not, we have a few slides to revisit on the asset allocation implementation before we move on to the return discussion with Siegel. Okay. John, can you go to 71, please? Thank you, Aaron, Leo. So if you guys remember from last month on the asset allocation implementation, there are two key questions we need to consider. The first being, how quickly should we move to implement the 6% reduction in the safe reserve target? We could naturally pay benefits from that cash and short-term bonds, and it would take about a year with quarterly cash outflows being 1.5% to get from 15 down to 9. We're recommending that we get to the new target by the end of the year 2021, kind of on a quarterly basis. It would be a combination of natural depletion from benefit outflows plus some reinvestment into the liquid asset class portfolios. Tina, you had the question last month of, you know, why not just do it right away? And there's not really a right answer, at least until we get to the end of the year and look at it in hindsight. But this is consistent with the feedback we got from the IAC when we talked about it. We have some good clarity on private market distributions coming up. So I like the combination of a reduction through benefit payments combined with some new reinvestment into the liquid asset classes. And we also have the two new mandates to small cap coming up, one that will probably be funded over the summer and one likely into Q4 that we can use part of this reduction in the safe reserve to fund those. So any questions on that plan or concerns about the timing we're talking about moving to implement that reduction? Okay. The other aspect of it is how we want to reallocate money across the three asset classes that we're underweight to. John, this is on 72. I'm proposing that we reinvest equal weights into global equity, EM equity, and EM debt. So if we have $60 million to allocate, we would go $20 million each into those asset classes until we get to the – I'm getting a ton of feedback noise, John. If people can go on mute if you're not talking. Okay, that's better. Thanks. So if we have $60 million to allocate, we would just go $20 million apiece into EM equity, EM debt, and global equity until we get to that – likely 5% target to EM equity, which is the market weight target. And even if we have a higher target, we would stop there as a proposed cap to RBC, the EM equity manager. EM debt until we get to the 4% target. And then once we get those two to those targets, any excess would flow into global equity. On 73, we looked at this chart last time, but it's just slightly updated, which shows one more slide forward, John. So through the end of the year, we'd have $63 million coming out of the safe reserve to pay benefit outflows. That's a $9 million a month. We would have another $53 million reduction in column B to get down to the 9% target by year end. Column C shows expected private market distributions through the end of the year. $75 million, most of it coming out of real estate. Combined, that would be $128 million back into the three asset classes I just talked about with some minor rebalancing. You can see it takes about $40 million to get up to target in EM debt. At the top of the page in column D, $32 million to get up to the 5% target in EM equity, and then the rest would go into global equity. So we'll come back in next month to finalize allocation and implementation, and then there'll be some tweaks to the IPS likely the following month to effectuate everything in the policy. But any questions until we revisit next month? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Ryan. Next up, we have actuarial valuation assumptions by Jeff Williams from Siegel. And Kelly, do you have anything to preface us with?
I do. Thank you. I want to just remind the board that it is the board's responsibility to determine the assumptions to use in the actuarial evaluation. And the way we do that is we rely on recommendations from Siegel. And as Jeff will talk about, we changed a lot of the assumptions last year. This presentation we put at this point in the year and also in conjunction kind of with the asset allocation because it made sense to look at the assumed rate of return while we were looking at the asset allocation. But what I want to just make sure that I say, and you all know this, but when we're talking about the asset allocation, you know, the board is setting that based on what you think is the right asset allocation for DPFP based on what you think is the right risk level and other goals. It's not that we are picking an assumed rate of return and setting the asset allocation to meet that. But what I wanted to do is have Siegel show you if you do want to lower the assumed rate of return, what that means based on the prior year's valuation for the funding level of the plan. But just wanted, you know, just to say, because sometimes people question this, we're setting the asset allocation based on what the board thinks is the right asset allocation based on the risk return and the other goals for the plan, not to meet some predetermined number by that we've set to earn for the fund. So just wanted to say that. And with that, I'll turn it over to Jeff.
All right, thank you. Can everybody hear me clearly?
Yes.
Yes, sir.
Okay, great. This is just a two-page memo, very kind of short to the point. Like Kelly mentioned, we value different discount rates based on the 2020 valuation, which is the latest valuation we've completed. The results of an experience study were included in the last valuation, so we changed. There's a widespread change of assumptions. We don't feel the need to address any other assumptions at this point in time, but we do have some analysis of what lowering the rate of return assumption would do. So dropping, we value your current assumption at 7%. We value 2020 valuation at 6.75, 6.5, 6.25, and 6%. And for every quarter point drop in the rate, your total normal cost increases about 6.8 to 6.9%. Your liability in the range of 2.7 to 2.8%, and as a percentage, your actuarial determined contribution around 4.4 to 4.5%. So, of course, if your liability is increasing and your assets are otherwise staying the same, your funded ratio would drop about 110 plus basis points on a market value basis and 115 to 120 points on an actuarial value of assets basis. So there's definitely an impact, which we know, lowering the discount rate. John, if you would switch to the next page, please. Thank you. So your far left column numbers are your actual 2020 evaluation results. And, of course, going across in quarter point drops, you can see the impact of what it would have. Now, you're not actually contributing the actuarially determined contribution. That, you know, you have a set rate for contributions, but this is something we do show in the valuation. And I think important parts are, well, it's all important, but your funded ratio at the bottom, you can see what that does. You know, you're projected to still remain solvent under these scenarios, but you know, depending on how far you drop is how much you're, if you drop to 6.5%, say the middle column, your market value is dropping, you know, about 2.4 points, 43.56 to 41.31. Your liability increases for each, it's not exactly straight linearly interpolated, but your liability is increasing, what, 128, 130 million, up to 150, depending on how well you get with discount rate per quarter point drop. So it obviously does have an impact. You know, I was listening to Makita's presentation, of course, and you know, I'm not qualified to do the analysis they do, but you know, they did show the impact of you know, the different mixes and the percentage of, we like to at least see a 50% chance of hitting your target mix over the long term. That's, you know, if you're getting less than the 50% chance of hitting your bogey, then that's you know, it's kind of hard to sometimes defend that on an actuarial basis. But yeah, I think lowering of the rate is probably in order. That's obviously a board decision. You know, we will, if the board decides to stick with 7% for one more year, you know, we certainly will do that. We're not going to, you know, fight that or anything, but I think the board should give some consideration to potentially lowering the discount rate.
What is the discount rate of? Yeah, I do. What is the discount rate of most of your clients, especially clients our size?
That varies. They've mostly come down to at least 7. We've got some. Asset situation is a lot different than most clients, though. You're still trying to unwind from some of your earlier investments, so most clients don't have that type of asset mix. So it's not quite an apples to apples, but NASRA, the National Association of State Retirement Administrators, they put out a survey of the public sector universe usually every year, sometimes twice a year. Their most recent one, I don't have that handy, but the median and mean returns were down close to 7. They're just over 7. They're less than 7.25, closer to 7. I have a client at 6.8, a multi-billion-dollar fund in Florida. Most of my clients are around 7%. I still do have one or two at 7.25. I'm trying to push down a little bit lower, but the trend has been consistently lowering over the last several years as the market outlook has changed. So you're within the large public sector universe at 7%. You're right about kind of the median or mean, but your asset allocation, you know, situation is a little bit different than most clients, or than most plans, I should say. So you're not an outlier at 7 by any means. It's just a matter of, is that appropriate for your fund?
One of the things that I would add is, you know, it's always important to put this number, what your best estimate is, and it certainly is an unknown. And we don't want to be too conservative or too aggressive in the number. One of the things to think about that is an additional kind of importance right now with DPFP is the mayor has that committee that's looking at funding for the pension system currently. And there's also that 2024 evaluation that needs to happen. And it would be a shame, I guess, is probably the right word, that if we go into that, to either of those processes, and come up with a solution for the pension system, and everybody thinks that that solution gets us, you know, to a position we want to be, and then we lower the rate a few months later or the next year, and all of a sudden we have a hole again. So I think it's really important to think about it's always important to think about what we think is the right number, but I think if we think that we need to lower that number, we should do that as people are looking for, you know, what is the size of issue that we're trying to solve here. So I think right now is the right time to look at lowering it. And I plan on coming back in the May meeting with a recommendation to lower it. I don't know right now to what level, but that's what I'm anticipating.
Well, to be clear, there's no advantage to keeping it high because all we're doing is having some sort of false sense of security. So whatever is, yeah, whatever is on the asset side, and that should not be driving us on this return assumption. The return assumption is a realistic view of where market returns are. And just to give some of the newer board members bigger than breadbox, when I was at Metro, we lowered our return assumption to 6.5 10 years ago. So just to give you some data point, I'm in the camp of wanting to lower it, you know, a reasonable amount. I mean, something like in the 6.5 at least, because I think moving it a quarter is really just kind of splitting hairs. If you're going to move it, let's move it, and everyone accept sort of the reality of where we are. So that's my two cents.
This is Michael. I agree. I don't see any reason to. I mean, I think this is the time to lower it, and I don't see any reason to have it high. I agree.
Thank you.
So, Kelly, you're going to sort of come with a recommendation next month. Is that generally what we're hearing?
Yes.
Let me ask
you
a question.
You know,
can I ask one question? Can I ask a question? Let's say hypothetically, if there is an obligation bond that does get done, accepted, and there is a material amount of money, you know, raised, do we revisit it and then potentially lift it again? I mean, like, how does that work?
Well, I mean, I would let Makita or Siegel or Ryan chime in, but I mean, we still, if you look at those mixes that we have there, it wasn't dependent on the amount of assets. I think we do have more risk of achieving those results just because of our legacy portfolio. But if we did get a lot of more proceeds come in all at once, I'm not sure it would change that. I don't know if Makita wants to help out with that answer.
Yes, Kelly, this is Leah. The market projections and the exhibits that Aaron went over would not change depending on the asset value. So your point is correct. However, if you do get additional assets, then the legacy illiquid piece will be a smaller component. So, yeah, I think it will be, you know, improving somewhat the actuality from the projected models of meeting that. So from my perspective, I wouldn't feel tempted to make any modifications just because we receive any extra money through a POD.
We do look at these every year. So that's the other thing I failed to mention is, you know, we do bring these assumptions back to the board annually. So it can always be raised or lowered.
Yeah, but just to be clear, the pension obligation bond only works if you can make money more than the borrowing of the pension obligation bond. And so it's not contingent on your return assumption. It really is about what are you actually returning. So that's the key to the pension obligation bond.
Right, and that's the key that I didn't think about. So, yeah, thank you.
Well, it really depends on how that is structured because just to remind you, we've had the city will issue the pension obligation bonds and the city will pay the debt service. So it really depends on really what, if any, adjustments they make to their contribution to that. So because we are not the city, it's kind of disassociated, which is unusual for the pension.
But it only works though if your return can be bigger. Because if it doesn't, then the balance sheet of the city is just deteriorating rapidly. I mean, it's got to work because the borrowing cost is lower than what you can earn.
Correct. When you take the city and the pension together and look at the overall effectiveness.
Yeah.
together. That's
well, I think that's what will be sort of analyzed by, you know, those that are putting this together for the city. And on that note, real quick, I know somebody had another question. Do we know if that mayor's group and Quinn and everyone, have they met already a couple of times? Do you know anything, Kelly, that you can share?
So I know that they have been meeting. It sounds like they've done a lot of work. I did meet with them virtually for one meeting and provided information on the pension obligation bonds and our analysis of that and some other pieces of information. It sounds to me like they are actually getting to a point that they might be making a recommendation to the city. I think that recommendation, and I don't know how much of this I'm supposed to be saying, but it doesn't seem confidential. I think that what the form of that recommendation might be, you know, here's three ways to solve this issue, or four ways. You could do this, you could do that, you could do the other thing. I don't think they're going to have one singular recommendation, and I don't think it's going to be very specific. I think it's going to be more of a, here's different ways to deal with this problem.
Well, Kelly, can I? I'd like to request, unless we're prohibited, to get an update on what they've been doing at one of the future board meetings. If they're prohibited, then that's fine. But if it's public and so forth, or they're not prohibited, yeah, it'd be great for us to know. Because as soon as there's any information out there, we're going to get bombarded by people, and the more we know ahead of time, the better.
Okay, I'll convey that to Bill. I haven't, like I said, I was only at the one meeting that I was invited to attend, and that's really all I know.
Yeah, I agree with Gilbert. I think we need an update, and that might be something that we put on the agenda for next month. But that's a really good point, Gilbert. And not to go too far down in the weeds, I want to try to keep us on a task here. We've got a little bit of a tight timeline. It's 9:40. I just want to go back to Jeff real quick. Did anybody else have a question on it regarding the valuation assumption? Okay, I want to go back to Jeff and give him the opportunity to wrap up before we go into closed session at 9:45.
Okay, thank you. I really don't have much more to say about the assumptions. The numbers are what they are. You know, usually when funds try to avoid lowering the discount rate, it's because they are paying the recommended contribution, and obviously that has a direct impact on that. Your situation is different. You've got statutorily set rates right now. So, you know, I agree that, you know, lowering it to what you think is appropriate makes sense, regardless of kind of where that puts you, but that's kind of outside my, you know, scope. I can't speak to it as Makita could, but I would say just put it where you're comfortable and where you think it makes sense. And Kelly has a good point about you want to be as realistic as possible before 2024 when this gets looked at again.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%, Jeff. You know, speaking from a historical standpoint, that was one of the things that got us in trouble is these pie in the sky valuations and not being realistic. So we can't make that mistake again.
Yeah,
thank you very much.
I agree.
All right. Anything else, Mr. Williams?
No, sir. Just one
thing. Thank you for your presentation.
I just want to say that the July 8th meeting, I will be out. I might be available. Caitlin Grice is also on this call. She is not available. So I won't know until closer to the meeting if I'll be able to call in if needed. I don't know if we'll be needed or not since you already have our analysis. I'll certainly call in if I can. I just won't know until it's closer to the meeting date if I'll be able to do so. I'll be on the road at that point.
Okay. All right. Sounds good.
Okay. Thanks, Jeff.
Okay.
And Caitlin.
Okay, Kelly and Josh, are we ready to move into closed session now?
I think so. Let me just check. Are Chuck Campbell, Mark Sales, Greg Taylor, are you all on the call?
Josh, I don't see any of them. They may be under numbers I don't have for them. If you're on the call, if any of the three are on, and press 5-star, and then I'll unmute you and let me clear everybody.
Okay. They were supposed to dial in at 9:45, so maybe they're just still, maybe they're late. We could maybe do one short item before then, if you want to, Kelly and Armando.
Yeah, but, that sounds good, Josh. Thank you. Kelly, would you like to discuss very quickly the item number five?
Here, let me clear everybody else.
Sorry, John?
I need to set up the phone call for closed session.
Well, we're not ready. We're going to wait until you know that the other people are on, and we were going to do another open session item until you can confirm that they might be available.
I got you. Didn't get that.
Okay.
John's a busy man. He's multitasking like crazy today.
Right.
We're pulling all these audibles on him. Poor guy.
I know.
Let's go ahead and talk about the chairman's discussion item. That shouldn't take too long. As many of you know, Alan Vaught is not on the call today, but it's been brought to my attention and to the chairman's attention that he has resigned from the board as he's been appointed by Mayor Johnson to another board. And I believe, and Kelly, correct me if I'm wrong, but he's actually going to be the chairman of the Veterans Committee. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. So he's stepping down from this board, and you know, we're working with the mayor's office to identify and select his replacement. So we just need to all be aware that vacancy exists and it will be filled soon. Is there any discussion on that?
The one thing I would add is our plan does allow for us to have holdover trustees. So even though Alan has resigned and the mayor's office told him that he had to resign to be appointed to the other board, he could serve as a holdover trustee until the mayor makes the reappointment. And he has indicated that he's willing to do that, but he needs permission from the mayor first, and he wasn't able to get that permission prior to this meeting. So we may hear from him at the next meeting, or maybe by then we'll have a new trustee. We don't know. It's kind of an evolving situation. But I appreciate his service. He's done a great job for us.
Yeah, he's been great. He's been great. Value his perspective on certain items, and we're going to miss him for sure. John, are we still trying to get everybody in?
No, we have the three participants we were waiting on.
Okay, sounds good. So at this time, we will go into closed session, and we expect to be in closed session looking at the order of business for about an hour. So if everybody wants to just hang on, and we'll finish the rest of the meeting when we get back, but we're going to go into closed session at this time for approximately 1 hour.